the intersection of information and conversation. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. And I just want to say, look, it's been a very interesting weekend from a news perspective, certainly here at TNT. Now, programming was a little bit disjointed on my show. Yesterday, we had Dave Hodges stick around for the second hour. We brought David McBride in to provide as much detail as we could. And I hope that you appreciate and enjoyed that segment yesterday. It was terrific. We had Stephen Mosher on earlier today with his brand new book, The Devil in Communist China. Stephen's got this incredible ability to provide details and facts that many of us are unaware of. The last hour was, we changed it up a little bit there. We brought Alex in to provide a little bit of perspective on what was happening, obviously with what happened in Bondi, but just to sort of get maybe a little bit of a preempt of what we could expect authority to sort of throw out there as solutions, as people will demand answers. And of course, rightly so, people want to know that they can eliminate risk in such a situation at a shopping centre on a Saturday afternoon in beautiful Australia, that something as horrific could happen. But of course, certain things are also isolated incidents, and of course, any society can have a madman, as it was, as many people are starting to realise at the moment. What I'm going to do is just present to you a little bit more information that I've picked up off news.com.au before I introduce you to my next guest, Kent Heckenlively, who will be on the phone experiencing his own internet troubles, and I can tell you all about those. I've just made the plunge, everyone, to get off the NBN here that doesn't work for me where I live, and had to take up Starlink. And let me tell you, when I did my first speed tests, I was blown away. I think I must have done 30 or 40 speed tests, because I can't believe the numbers that I was getting, five times faster on both download and upload speed than I was getting from the NBN, if you can believe that. Let it be known that private enterprise still has the wood on the government when it comes to providing services of efficient levels. Twice the price, but five times the speed. You've got to be happy with that. So just praying no satellites get in any clouds and block it in the next 59 minutes of this show, so that I can get you to the next interview that will be Dr. William Mackus in the next hour as well. So a lot happening. Now, let me bring you up to speed. The family of Joel Couchy, who we know went on the murderous rampage at Bondi Westfield, contacted authorities when they saw footage on television, because they believed it was their son. His family are said to be supportive of the police officer who shot him dead at Bondi Junction yesterday. And we know that he killed six and injured 12. Speaking in Brisbane, the Queensland Police Assistant Commissioner Roger Lowe said that the 40-year-old had come into contact with police over the past 4 years due to mental health issues, but had no criminal record. His family have cooperated with police, telling them that Queensland Race Couchy lived a drifting lifestyle and had intermittent contact with them. It's a difficult time to tell anyone that they've lost their son, Assistant Commissioner Lowe said. Their first thoughts are for us were to express their concerns regarding the family and victims of his crimes, and in particular, their thoughts around the police officer who would bravely act in such a manner. Couchy's family have reported their son was sleeping in a car and at backpacker hostels. Assistant Commissioner Lowe said Queensland Police had lost contact with Couchy in December, but stressed that there'd been nothing to previously indicate the man could be capable of such horrific acts. He has not been prosecuted or arrested or charged for any offence within Queensland, and he has no record within the courts for a domestic violence order. How about that? So, very important, as I said again, when it comes to the reporting of these issues, there are just so many times that people are trying to get information out, and of course, trying to realise where narratives are being perhaps pushed and counter narratives to understand what's going on here. But this more and more is starting to appear like an isolated incident of a person with known mental health issues. An incredibly horrific situation. The saddest for the people here in Bondi, of course, the eastern suburbs, a huge community, and we're realising just how close-knit the eastern suburbs community is around here. Well, we're going to change pace now in two ways, because I'm going to explain it all in a minute, but let me tell you about my next guest, Kent Heckenlively. Well, he's an attorney, a science teacher, and a New York Times best-selling author, best known for co-authoring the Plague series with Dr. Judy Mikovits and Dr. Frank Rossetti. He's currently working as an unofficial biographer for several Project Veritas whistleblowers. He's also the co-author of the Skywhoosh publishing book, The Case Against Vaccine Mandates, and the book Plague of Corruption, Restoring Faith in the Promise of Science. Now, he's also a first-time novelist. I'm going to tell you all about it. Kent Heckenlively, welcome to Weekends.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you on the show, Kent. And I'm sorry that your internet is performing worse than mine. I think I held, until this week, the worst internet contract in all of my country of Australia. And now I'm very proud to have a bit of fast internet for once. But here we are. I'm glad that I've got you on the phone. And I have to say, firstly, congratulations on your brand new endeavor. You've become a fiction writer of an incredible book. Tell us, how did you make the switch?
You know, what's really funny is I started off as a fiction writer. That was really what I was going to do with my writing career. And then I kind of got stuck in nonfiction and wrote 15 nonfiction books. And so I'm really kind of returning to my first love. This book is called The King of Italy. It's historical fiction set in Italy, Sicily, and America during the 20th century. It's about some real events that happened. A lot of people don't realize that Italy had its own monarchy from about 1860 to 1947. And so I crafted a story which takes into account a bunch of the history of that monarchy, as well as its connection to World War II, because it's had always seemed to me that everybody told the story of World War II generally through a German perspective or a Japanese perspective. And there was really, I thought, an opportunity to tell it from an Italian perspective, because what a lot of people don't realize is that Mussolini was in power in Italy from 1922 to 1945, so a period of 23 years. And he really set the tone for dictators in Europe. And in fact, Hitler considered him to be his idol and his model. And so I thought, gee, I really want to put a story together about what happened to Italy, what happened to America, some real life characters who lived that history, and really to tell a different story, not only of Italian history, but of American history, because it had always kind of annoyed me that the most common Italian narrative in the United States, at least, is the mafia narrative. And, you know, that's a small percentage of the Italian community. And so I thought I wanted to tell an immigrant story involved with Italy, involved with the American dream. And I really think I always talk about this story as a bit of a combination of The Godfather and Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. So looking really kind of at, the question that is asked in the book is, you know, do you choose the path of the shepherd or the wolf? And I think that that's something that we see, whether it's the Roman Empire, the American Empire, what do we do with power, and how do we exercise it effectively?
It's just an amazing setup, Kent. And I'm just thinking, as you're explaining the situation there, and when you mentioned The Godfather and Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, I'm thinking, I mean, talk about setting the bar at an incredible level, but you have just put something special together. Even the little book trailer that explains it, it feels like that in maybe 5 years' time, we'll be going to the cinema to see a film adaptation of this incredible book, The King of Italy. Did you think about a possible film adaptation at some stage in the future as you put the book together?
Absolutely. I hope that at some point you'll show that audience the trailer, because I know you have it. And it was so much fun to put that together, because what I'm always trying to do with my books is to be on the cutting edge of marketing as well as of storytelling. And so when my publicist had said that they're now using AI to generate movie quality book trailers, and then I saw what they were able to do with it, I just flipped for it. So I'm really happy that you responded so positively to that book trailer.
It's just very interesting, Wayne, and it's amazing, Kent, that you explain again the marketing side of it, because you know we speak to I certainly speak to many authors on this program, and I just admire one, the ability to be able to write any book, the commitment to be able to do it, to never give up, to get it to a level. And of course, these days, perhaps the barrier to entry might be a little lower because people can self-publish, and in the digital age, it's a bit different. But you still have to write something, you still have to research it, you still have to go through the process. And I think that many of the authors who get to maybe do their first book, second book, if they go that far, then realizing that there is a huge marketing campaign to build awareness. And it's not a case of just writing a book, it goes up on Amazon, and then all of a sudden it goes viral. It's no different to a social media post, right? You've got to be able to go out there and market it. It may involve hundreds upon hundreds of interviews on all platforms to be able to tell the story. And so it is, you know, one way or another, it's a nickel and dime approach to be able to, you know, to sell one book, two books, and maybe 100 books, and then 1,000, and then 10,000, then off you go. But you being a best-selling author would know all about that approach. Is it any different for any of the books from nonfiction to fiction, for example, in the process of marketing?
You know, it's a great question, because I'm kind of unique in that my publishers will often bring me projects because they know that I'm a quick writer. I can put a book together in approximately 3 to 4 months. And so when they've got a hot story, like, for example, my publisher had brought me the project with Alex Jones and InfoWars. Could I put a book together for him? I've actually put two books together for him. And, you know, those are books that, you know, I will do. And, you know, there's already a built-in marketing program through InfoWars. And so, you know, I'll do a book like that, and, you know, we'll sell 80 to 100,000 copies. And then, you know, I'll jump onto another story like I did with the diversity, equity, and inclusion story. I worked with the Project Veritas whistleblower, David Johnson. And, you know, I'm selling, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 copies. And I love both books equally. You know, you try to do the same sort of marketing program and everything. And it really just is, you know, luck of the dice. I mean, one of the things that I had heard early in my career is that the most prolific authors are also the most remembered authors. You know, they talked about the composers, Mozart, Beethoven, Shakespeare himself as a writer. You know, these were the most prolific artists of their time. You know, Shakespeare is thought to have written over 60 plays, and we remember 4 or 5 of them. Same things with the great composers. They would do 60 or 70, you know, symphonies or operas, and they're often only remembered for, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 of those. And so I just took the perspective that if I could learn how to write quickly and well, I would put my effort into writing a number of books, knowing that some of them are really going to, you know, resonate with people. Others, you know, may have a more limited audience, but I'm just always going to have those next books lined up. You know, it's The King of Italy has really been a labor of love for me for probably 25, 30 years. You know, it was kind of interesting to realizing I'd written this story before I'd met my wife, and it was one of the first things that we talked about. And, you know, I said I'd always wanted to be a fiction writer. And then, you know, as I said, I got kind of not stuck in nonfiction, but I got the opportunity in nonfiction and ran with it. And so it's really kind of fun to, you know, now she's seen it, you know, the imprint, I've got the advanced copies of it. And so, you know, I'm just always, I'm working on the next project. I've got a book scheduled to come out in July, and I've got another one coming out in probably September. One is about the Sony hack of 2014 that was blamed on North Korea. The one that's coming out in September or October is with a whistleblower from the CIA. And I just kind of figure like I kind of feel like I'm a bit like the actor Michael Caine, who would always take projects because he didn't know if the next one would ever come along. And so as long as people want me to write stories, I'm going to be writing stories, and as long as publishers keep paying me to write the stories and promising to publish them, you know, I'll be working as hard as I can.
That's wonderful. It really, really is. We're going to take our first break. We're going to come back and explore more of Kent's writing. And like they say, a writer writes. Well, why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all the major social media platforms, including Facebook, X, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. You can help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT.
TNT's State of the Nation.
President Xi of China absolutely has his eyes on Taiwan. He always has. And America has been a steadfast supporter of Taiwan until Stumblebum Joe hit the scene. And now President Xi says no one can stop the, quote, family reunion with Taiwan. These people really want a war, don't they?
Family reunion. Well, that's a great title for what we got going on the grand chessboard here, isn't it? Yeah, they've been telegraphing this one for a long time, and no surprises here, Timothy.
And, you know, I think that the Taiwanese might have something to say about that being a family reunion. Like Ashley Biden not wanting a family reunion with Joe. Like, she doesn't want another shower with Pedo Joe. I think that's how Taiwan must feel.
State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT radio listeners rely on TNT radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. TNTRadio.live.
Online.
Online.
Online streaming.
Be a part of the conversation.
I stream it all at work, and I stream it to my phone and listen to it wherever I go.
TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour is probably the most prolific author that I've ever spoken to on this show, being Weekends. We've spoken to lots and lots of incredible authors, but I don't know anyone who's put together as much work as Kent Heckenlively. Kent, I'm just looking at part, not all of the catalogue, and I'm just going to read for the benefit of our viewers and listeners. We might put a couple of the book titles on the screen, but just give you an idea. We've talked about The King of Italy, your brand new novel that releases on the 16th of April, but The Plague of Corruption that you co-wrote with Dr. Judy Mikovits, also Presidential Takedown, How Anthony Fauci, the CDC, the NIH, and the WHO work together to overthrow President Trump. The Truth About Masks, also written with Judy Mikovits. Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism. And Behind the Mask of Facebook, The Case for Interferon. Kent, it's an incredible list of books that you've put together.
I just decided, how can I be the most controversial writer in the world?
So controversial, in fact, and this is how crazy it is, that I was reading stories in the Sydney Morning Herald and the Australian. You weren't even allowed to come to Australia.
Oh, in 2017, your lovely country banned me from coming to talk.
It's just unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, could there be a more informed human being than an author who's written that amount of books with so many experts? How did they justify it to you, or was it just a blanket refusal?
You you know, I probably should have come with a trigger warning for your audience, because your lovely Australian government banned me from coming to talk about vaccines because in their official language, they said I was a threat to the political order of Australia.
Wow, that's an impressive leap there, isn't
it? That's the actual language that the Australian government used. Your wonderful Minister of Immigration, Dutton, I guess.
Goodness me. And you know who Peter Dutton is today? He's now the leader of the opposition party of Australia and a fair chance to defeat Anthony Albanese sometime before next May to become our next Prime Minister. That's what you're dealing with here in this country. And you can see why so many people are not just politically apathetic, but now politically contrarians, because the main two political parties, which effectively is a uni party, behaves in such a way that free thought and free speech are a thing of the past in a country such as Australia that has always considered itself the lucky country, but doing anything it possibly can to remove that title permanently, Kent.
Yeah, so it's my banning was up in 2020, so I have not reapplied to visit Australia, but maybe to cause a little bit more trouble, I should.
No, absolutely. When you sit down when you write with a co-author such as Dr. Judy Mikovits, you must have been exposed to a treasure trove of information and perspective. Of course, you've written many books before this particular stage, but was it more of the same and just an expansion of knowledge at that point? Or was it something else when you sit down to just realize that that time and time again, there is just so much information that somehow gets censored out of the mainstream narrative?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I have written a lot of books, but I jokingly say that I feel that I am writing the same book over and over again, because I deal with whistleblowers, and usually whistleblowers are people who believe deeply in the values of the organization they're working with. And when something happens that departs from those ideals, they're the first people to stand up. And they think they're standing up for the organization. And what they often find is that the ideals of the organization are not consistent with what the management wants to do. I think the perfect example of that is my book, Presidential Takedown, which I co-authored with Dr. Paul Alexander, who was the, his official title was Senior Pandemic Advisor. And he'd come from the World Health Organization. And so in March and April, as the lockdown was happening in the United States, he found himself yelling at the TV every night when Tony Fauci appeared, and he was writing articles on behalf of the World Health Organization that this was the wrong thing to do. And lo and behold, in April of 2020, he gets a call from the White House saying that they've been reading his work. They want him to come and you know, give an independent view of what Fauci's group is doing. He agrees to that. And, you know, one of the first things that he says to them is that in 2019, the World Health Organization had put together an enormous study looking at all the available science to determine what should be done if there was an outbreak of a infectious respiratory virus. They looked at 9 things, including social distancing, and they concluded that only 2 of them made sense. And those 2 things were additional hand washing and quarantining of high risk populations like elderly people or the immune compromised. And so he just found himself, you know, at war basically with Anthony Fauci's COVID-19 commission. And he was actually joined by a fair number of other people. I think somebody else who tried to stop the madness was Dr. Robert Redfield, who is head of the CDC. But there was just like an entire machinery going. And you know, it's interesting to me because my work with Dr. Judy Mikovits was, you know, she was on the outside of the government health establishment and saying that things were terrible. And Dr. Alexander was on the very inside. I mean, he was in the center of the scientific world. And his story was very much the same. And I was fascinated to work on that story because, you know, it's one thing to have a view as an outsider. It's another to hear the inside story and to find out it was just as bad as the outsiders were saying about it. And so, you know, if you know Dr. Alexander's story, he basically, you know, lasted 6 months in the job because in the fall of 2020, he was arguing that children should be back in school because the evidence did not support closing the schools. And it was Dr. Alexander's opinion that even though he was presenting them with all the science, the fix was in to get Trump out of the White House. And they thought one of the most effective tools to do that would be to have a whole bunch of upset parents, you know, who couldn't go back to work, whose kids were at home, you know, everybody's kind of stir crazy at home, and they just want to, you know, get rid of that administration. And what happened was a very dirty trick was played on Dr. Alexander. They stole one of his emails and published it in the Washington Post, a very long email post, but they took out four simple words, which was we want them infected, saying that we want school children to be infected because they don't really get sick. And the scientific reason for that is that the way the virus gained entry to the cells was through something called the ACE2 receptor on your cells, but it's not really active in children. So children were not getting really infected. They weren't having high viral loads. They'd, you know, have some sniffles and that was about it. But the fix was in to get President Trump out, and you know, the deep state or establishment, whatever you want to call it, medical mafia, wanted to simply cause chaos in the country and get Trump out, and that's what they did.
Yeah, they certainly did, one way or another. Dr. Paul Alexander is a prolific writer on Substack, so if anyone wanted to check out his work, I certainly recommend looking him up there. But he did become a critic of President Trump, and in fact was supporting in the primaries there for a while Chris Christie, which I thought was an interesting perspective. Were you aware of that?
You know, that really comes as a surprise to me because he was very... and during the writing of the book, he was very pro-Trump. You know, I'd ask him about that because I had raised the issue that, you know, as much as Paul had a certain view of what should happen, Trump really did, in the end, follow the mainstream view. And, you know, Paul's response to me was... You know, and this was actually kind of scary to me to hear because, you know, it's one thing to be on the outside, but what Paul had said was even on the inside, the story that they were getting was that Trump was being physically threatened. There were threats of violence against his children. You know, and these were rumors, but here he is in the center of our government. And nobody seems to know what's true or not. And I didn't know if I found that to be the most terrifying thing of all, that, you know, you can hear these crazy people saying, like, you know, they're going to do a John F. Kennedy on him. And, you know, I said, well, is that what people are saying inside those buildings? And he said, yeah, that's exactly what they were saying in those buildings. And so I don't think we really understand how straitjacketed the leaders in many countries have become. I think In the United States, we just had a very interesting situation come with the with a part of the Patriot Act, which is with warrantless wiretapping. And so what happened was the Speaker of our Congress, a guy named Mike Johnson, had been a critic of the warrantless wiretapping. And what happens? He becomes Speaker of the House. The intelligence people take him into a room in a skiff. They show him a bunch of information. And, you know, there's no way to verify if what the intelligence agencies are telling him is true. And then he comes out and goes, well, now I've had the talk. Now I'm in favor of warrantless wiretapping. And you just find yourself saying, you know, why is the intelligence agency running our government? And I really have to strongly say that no matter which way you come out on it, the fact is you have to say that the intelligence agencies are running our government. Now, you can say that that happens in two ways. You could say, well, the intelligence agencies know what's true, and then they're telling our politicians what is true, and then the politicians are doing that, you know, and they're being responsible. Or you can say the intelligence agencies bring the powerful people in, they lie to them, there's no punishment to the intelligence agencies for lying to the politicians, so the politicians are making are basing their policies on what the intelligence agencies are telling them, whether it's true or false. But to me, that really means that the intelligence agencies are running our governments.
Absolutely. This is which we've been watching since the death of John F. Kennedy. It feels like that was the moment where the intelligence agencies took over the US government. An interesting perspective, Kent, is that one of Australia's former prime minister, Paul Keating, a Labor prime minister, these days, a very interesting perspective. He was thrown out of office back in 1996 when defeated by Conservative leader John Howard. He was criticised intensely for the recession we had to have back in the early 1990s, where interest rates in this country rose to something like 17%, the official rate. He then removed the government's controlling of interest rates and set it up with the Reserve Bank. But many years later, he was revered that the economic reforms that he looked over actually helped Australia quite well. But in the later years, there's been controversy with his daughter walking out of the Epstein mansion in New York, he himself with the rumor mill, etc. But what was interesting was in a recent interview he gave on the ABC, Australia's government TV channel, he made light of the Australian intelligence officers and referred to them as like spooks or something along those lines, basically saying, I don't listen to the intelligence agencies, which paints a very different picture to what we might have here in Australia versus over there in the United States. To consider a US president being intimidated in such a way, certainly one with a skin as thick as or a hide as thick as Donald Trump's, it seems that he's the only person in the world that can resist sticks and stones. But even Trump was in a situation there that that even he wasn't able to handle, at least in that first term. Look, I've just noticed the time, and I want to just hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back because I really want to get into this. It's a fascinating topic because, of course, you've also got connections with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and I think that all of this works well, and it's very, very worthy of a discussion. So don't go anywhere. We'll be back here with more here on Weekends with Jason Olborn. You're watching and listening to TNT.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets with nowhere to go. I didn't think I'd survive. But I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
1 in 10 young adults will experience a form of homelessness this year. For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there.
Covenant House helped me break the cycle of homelessness in my family. They gave me the love that I needed.
Over 2,000 young people will sleep safely in a Covenant House bed tonight. When youth who are experiencing homelessness have a hot meal, a safe place to sleep, medical care, and love, they can overcome heartbreaking challenges and have a brighter future.
They just really genuinely just wanted to help me succeed, and I'm succeeding.
I'm a speaker, I'm an author. Covenant House really helped me and really helped mold me into the woman I am today.
If you or someone you love is asking for help, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
Hi, I'm Abel.
I often forget to mention that he's an amputee because Abel will try any activity he can.
My arm helps me with basically everything.
He doesn't see what he can't do, he sees what he can do.
This is helping.
The War Amps has just given him the ability to do all the activities every kid can do.
When you donate to the War Amps, you help kids like me. Thank you!
When the whole world seems turned upside down, we sort through it together. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back. And it is the sorting through that we are doing together. And it just seems that each segment, there's more developing news, this time again out of Sydney in relation to Joel Couchy, the 40-year-old murderer of six people yesterday at Bondi. And I'm just going to give you another update that I've found on news for you. The schizophrenic man, that's what they're calling him, behind the stabbing rampage in Bondi, left six people dead, advertised as a male escort online offering closed door services. It's now been removed. It was first uncovered by The Australian. Couchy presented himself as an athletic, good-looking 39-year-old guy. So that's an interesting development here, because what we've noticed is that the two of the victims were stunningly beautiful women who were murdered in cold blood, obviously, in these stabbing attacks. And we've also seen social media posts being shared explaining that Couchy was looking for friendship, companionship, and this attempt here at this escort service shows us what we're dealing with here with this this particular individual, clearly alone, lonely, and looking for some form of connection. It's just the most horrific story, and it just seems to be getting worse and worse. But at last, we're getting interesting facts and pieces of the puzzle being put together. So I present you with that update there. Now, my guest this hour is Ken Heckenlively, and we've been talking about an insider's view, would you believe, inside the Trump White House, as it referred to through Dr. Paul Alexander, who was in charge of the pandemic process there in the White House. Kent, what's interesting is that what I was alluding to before the break was how the spy agencies like you were doing have pretty much taken over the government of the United States, probably here in Australia. But Paul Keating showed some resistance recently, our former prime minister. Now, Donald Trump, 69 years of age, never been in politics before, a billionaire, adores his family, decides to run for president and put himself at risk. So he knows the risks of what's going on, but you're saying that he knew, or at least people inside the White House also knew what was going on. How does a man do that and then now 4 years later continue? You would think that he would put his tail between his legs, go and retire and enjoy his twilight years, but in fact the opposite. He insists that he's going to save America.
You know, one of the things that I feel so fortunate about is that I work with whistleblowers, and I think that there's just a special breed of human beings, maybe it's 1-2% of the population, who simply will not give up. And I hand it to Trump for being that kind of a person. And, you know, right now I'm working with an author. His name is Kevin Shipp. He's a former CIA agent who is a whistleblower. And he just went through, you know, a terrible situation with the CIA. And, you know, he is a man of tremendous courage. And when I work with these people, I just find it so inspiring, because I feel like there's so much darkness in our world. And I'm so fortunate to work with people who stand up against that darkness. And what I hear time and again from these people, because that's always a question that I ask them, is like, why are you choosing to stand up? You know, more often than not, what that means is a lot of pain for these whistleblowers. They will lose their job, they will lose family, they'll lose friends. And I just am so inspired by the human spirit in these people. who just say it's wrong. And you know, mostly they're people of religious faith, not always, but they're just people who refuse to be slaves. They refuse to be quiet. And I think that so much of human history has been the result of brave people like that. And so, you know, when I work with these people, it inspires me to be even more courageous. I say to myself, you know, what is the most courageous thing I could do? What is the most honest thing I can do? And also, what is the kindest thing I can do? You know, what is the best thing I can do for my fellow human beings? You know, how are my fellow human beings suffering? What could I do today that would be of the greatest benefit to people? Sometimes that is telling the unvarnished truth about something really dark. Other times that might be just, you know, visiting with a friend and spending a couple hours listening to them share their story of woe. But I think that one of the things that has just really enriched my life through this writing and makes it not a drudgery but a joy every day is I'm inspired by the people I write about because they are trying to do the right thing, really, no matter the cost. And I just think that's something that, you know, all of us, you know, will hopefully come to understand as we get older and wiser, is that, you know, we have a few brief years on this planet, and let's make them heroic years. Let's be the very best, kindest, most well-informed human beings that we can be, and then let's see what kind of a world that creates.
It makes total sense, doesn't it? Now, this next question is going to sound a bit silly, because when you think about it, what would possess a whistleblower to be a fake whistleblower? My question is, have you ever met a whistleblower that you didn't believe?
That's a great question. You know, I am one of the stories that is like number three on my list is what's been happening with the story on UFOs and our Congress. Mm. And there is this whistleblower, David Grush.
Yes.
Who is saying some amazing things. And yet I'm also talking to other people who are questioning whether they really believe everything that he is saying and whether he might be being used by other people. So I find that interesting. Also, what was interesting to me in my Facebook story is, you know, here I write a story of a Facebook whistleblower, Ryan Hartwig, who is a genuine hero. And he gets little press in the United States. And out comes, 6 months after our book comes out, there's another Facebook whistleblower, and she gets put in front of the United States Senate to testify. But what she's testifying about is Facebook is not doing enough to police content. And so there needs to be government regulation over these tech companies. And I'm saying to myself, well, geez, how is it that, you know, this person, you know, is, you know, profiled in the New York Times, gets on 60 Minutes, all this other stuff, gets in front of the United States Senate because she's saying, oh, the government needs to take over these corporations. And my guy who's saying, well, gee, they're prejudiced against conservatives and doing all these things and discriminating. And he gets no coverage in the mainstream media. Mm. So I think that there are some strategic fake whistleblowers out there. It's kind of funny because I find myself going like, okay, if a whistleblower gets the attention of everybody, like what happened with Trump and this guy Alexander Vindman, who supposedly, yes, you know, listened to the Ukrainian phone call, the perfect Ukrainian phone call. It's like, okay, if he's a real whistleblower, I expect him to get into a lot of trouble. Well, Vindman hasn't gotten into any trouble. And in fact, I think he's probably working in an even higher position in the Biden administration. So as far as I'm concerned, Vindman is a fake whistleblower, like the fake Google whistleblower, and maybe like the fake UFO whistleblower. I'm not sure about that guy, but I got my concerns.
That's a really interesting point with Dave Grush, because we're in a topic that we kind of more or less have had an unofficial, the gentlest possible UFO disclosure. I mean, until a US president actually announces it from the Oval Office with actual video footage and photographs, it can't be official. But we've more or less been told that there's something more than nothing. And the way that you explain that in terms of Grush, that he may have been influenced by people, and this is the point, isn't it? The disinformation that's interspersed with truth. And you only need, in the case of Grush, to have one thing proven to be a lie, and therefore that man is discredited across the board. He can't recover at that point. So this is the art of an information war, is to plant the wrong information and allow that to come to the surface. I find that very disturbing. And at the same time, the other example that you provided is the person that gets no coverage versus the person that gets all the coverage, and therefore you know that the dominant narrative prevails. And therefore, if truth is inversely proportional to views that you get on social media, then I can guarantee you, therefore, that the information that I'm putting out is 100% truth. That's all I can say to you. The shadow bands are unbelievable these days.
Yeah. You know, I always joke that if you're a real whistleblower, what that means is in 3 months, you're going to be driving for Uber. You know?
Yes. That's exactly right. It's just so obvious, isn't it? Do you look at a certain subject and think that it's just too far gone and it can't be true? Or given the work that you've done now and written so many books, that your mind is open to virtually anything?
You know, it's a great question, because I with the stories that I work on, I'm just like, okay, what the heck is going to come down the pike next for me? You know, yeah. Who are you going to have me talk? You know, because oftentimes publishers have more good stories waiting to be told than they have writers who can get that story out in a reasonable period of time. So yes. I'm really in a great position with the publishers, because good stories come to them, but these people are usually not good and quick writers. So I never know what's going to come down the pike for me. And I really have to say that I kind of feel like my job is to vet all the sources and to tell the story as honestly as I can, and also be aware that I may not know the answer to the question. I mean, this book that's coming out in July about the Sony hack of 2014 that was blamed on North Korea, I start the book out saying, you know, the difficulty in telling this story is every group that I'm looking at are known liars. Hollywood executives, the intelligence community, and foreign nations. All of these people are liars. So
yes.
How can I tell a true story when it's full of liars? I just do the best to document it. I'll tell you what I think, and then at the end I'll tell you, make up your own mind.
Absolutely. Now, you, in the book Plague of Corruption that you wrote with Judy Mikovits, the foreword was by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Have you had the chance to talk to Bobby Kennedy privately? And is there anything that in his election campaign that inspires or motivates you as we look forward to the election of 2024? Fingers crossed.
Yeah, and you know, I really, you know, so people know where I'm politically. I've generally been a conservative, but I've really been very impressed by Kennedy. The fact that he did the foreword. Three of my books have been published under his Children's Health Defense label. I am a supporter of his. What I find really interesting about the Kennedy campaign is that I have a daughter with autism, and that's really how I came to know him. And he has said that he will die with his boots on for our kids. And I believe him. And I find his criticism of Trump to be the most honest and constructive that I've heard, which is that as much as Trump promised to drain the swamp, in his first term at least, the people he put in to head the agencies were not those who were likely to drain the swamp. So he may have had a very limited pool of people to deal with. He may have not really known how bad the swamp was, even though that was what he ran on. Kennedy talks about how he's been suing these federal agencies for 35 years, and he knows how to make them work correctly. And, you know, I go back and forth because I hear people like Vivek Ramaswamy talk about getting rid of 75% of the federal workforce, and I like that at first blush. And then I hear Kennedy saying, no, structurally, things need to change, and then the government will work much better. I don't know which of those two I like the best. I kind of, you know, by a hair, I like Kennedy's approach. I like that he is not engaged in the toxicity of that we get between the Republicans and Democrats that, you know, while I do think that the Democrats in the United States are a threat to democracy and the Republicans are not, I find that Kennedy has not made his campaign a personal attack on either Republicans or Democrats, and I appreciate that. And I just am so much in favor of civility. I'm very much in favor of saying exactly where we disagree. But I just don't want to engage in personal attacks. I don't like that. I don't like insults. And I find myself incredibly inspired by the Kennedy campaign. I don't know if he has a chance, but until the election is done, I'm going to be a Kennedy supporter.
And look, if the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and the fact that Kennedy goes his hardest, Trump goes his hardest, Biden and the establishment certainly will, and the chips let the chips fall where they may. But I can't help but think that Kennedy.
One of the things that I've been saying to anybody who will listen to me is that I think that Trump is most likely to win the election at this point. But I think if he does, the smartest thing he could do is the day after, if he makes Kennedy attorney general, that would be the smartest thing he could do, because half of the country is going to be terrified. Falsely, I might add, because the Democrats have nothing to fear from Republicans. But if he put Kennedy in there, that would be such a wonderful 1-2 punch against the deep state establishment, that, and I think it would unify the country. So as much as I'm a Kennedy supporter, I do also recognize the incredible power that Trump has, the incredible drive that the man has.
Sorry, Ken, to cut you off there. We've just run out of time. We're about to go to the break, but I want to thank you for your time. I totally agree with you. I believe that will be the way it is. Trump and Kennedy as the Attorney General. I just want to say thank you, Kent Heckenlively, for an incredible interview today. We're going to take a break, and Dr. William Mackus will be here on the other side. Don't go anywhere. This is Weekends on TNT.